Hello, and welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. In every program, we look at a new book that is especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. Today, I had the pleasure of talking with Abdelkader Tayoub, professor of religion at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. His new book, Religion in Modern Islamic Discourse, explores the notion of religion through several modern Muslim intellectuals. Often, modern Islam is seen not necessarily as a return to religion, but of a continuation of tradition. I mean to say, Islam is commonly understood as resistant to modernity and incompatible with contemporary secular societies. Tayyub's new book, Religion in Modern Islamic Discourse, he challenges this perception through various analytical vignettes of key figures and debates occurring over the past 100 years or so. Professor Tayyub employs religion not as an essential category of examination, but rather as a guiding mode through which he explores several Muslim debates about identity, science, politics, law, gender. The characters involved in these dialogues span across the globe from South Asia, the Middle East, and North America, and give voice to both male and female perspectives. We are left with a nuanced examination of modern Islamic thought, which has been carefully contextualized in a critical, disruptive, and engaging way. Overall, he presents a wonderful thematic resource for understanding the adaptation and resistance to modernity as Muslims begin to reconcile Islam with the forces of modernization and secularization. And now, here's the interview. Good morning. Welcome to New Books in Religion. This is your host, Christian Peterson. And today, I have the pleasure of talking with Abdelkader Tayoub, a professor of religion at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. Good morning, Abdelkader. How are you?
Hello, good morning.
So today we're going to be talking about his new book, Religion in Modern Islamic Discourse. This is another new book by the partnership between Columbia and Hearst on modern Muslim intellectuals. In Abdelkader's case, we are taken through the 19th and 20th century, various debates about identity, gender, politics, and the role religion plays in all of these. Before we get into the book, Abdelkader, can you just tell us about yourself and some of your background?
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, first of all, for having me. And yes, I'm born in South Africa. I grew up in a very small town, very far from Cape Town. But I've had the privilege of being educated in a number of places. First started in South Africa. I then had the opportunity to learn some more Arabic in Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s, before eventually coming to Temple University to Philadelphia, where I spent four or five years doing a doctorate. But since then, I've been back in South Africa. I've been teaching at university of Cape Town for as long as I can remember. But in between, I've had the opportunity of going as a visiting professor to different places, back to America, but also recently much more extensively in Europe. This particular book started when I was in the Netherlands for about 4 years. And since then, it has sort of developed. And well, in 2010, it became a book.
Yeah, I've been following your work on religion and Islam pretty closely, and I noticed that you've taken various perspectives and approaches throughout the years. How did you come to write this book in the form you have right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I can mention specifically two major influences. Or maybe just, you know, promptings. And I've realized that I do things differently, but I think that the influences have shaped my decision. So the first one is Talal Asad, whose work I've been following for a long time, I think from the 1980s onwards, particularly when he has been writing about religion and the construction of the religion in relation to the sacred, to the secular. So he's book Genealogies of Religion, and then later the book on Formations of the Secular have been quite influential. I just thought it was quite an interesting idea to dislodge religion as a stable category. So that's, the Tal al-Assad has been a major influence on me. On the other hand, my colleague in the department, David Chittister, I don't think I quote him as much, but I've been also been very much reading him extensively, and I also have the opportunity to talk to him also about things. He said he has been looking at the construction of religion on the frontier, on the colonial frontier. So religion as not sort of being a neutral category, but somehow produced in a colonial encounter was something that was very attractive to me. So with those two ideas, with that background, I thought Tal al-Assad was not doing as much on Islam, so I thought I could do something. I know he speaks about Islam, but I think he has much more to say about the development of religion in Europe rather than in the Islamic societies. And he sort of touches, and he's very suggestive about what one can see in Islamic context. Particularly, there's an interesting essay of his, Information of the Secular, where he speaks about Muslims in, at least modernist Muslims as such. But I wanted to depart from him because I didn't agree with some of his analyses as such. But I think that I still count him as a major influence in my work.
Great. There's a few things you touch upon kind of to set the book up. And one of these premises you discuss in the introduction is you talk about how intellectual histories of modern Muslims can challenge these cultural interpretations of Islam. Could you discuss how that does that?
Yes, I think that the way to begin, I think, to look at that is to look at the dominant, or rather say the predominant approaches to the study of modern Islam, which I think, you know, the first one is the understanding that there is a continuity of Islam, modern Muslims who live in modernity are not really modernized. I mean, they're not really producing something very different. And if they're producing something different, they're not affecting a very large numbers of Muslims. So there, I'm obviously thinking about people like Bernard Lewis and earlier von Grunebaum and others who studied early Islamic texts and basically look at modern Muslim representations of Islam and saying there isn't really something major, very, very different in a way. I mean, even when they look at Muslim modernists, they say basically that they don't really depart from, you know, standard definitions of Islam. They might differ on a few things, but they accept the structure as such. On the other hand, I think there have been others who have been saying that actually Muslims, one cannot understand Islam, or one cannot understand modern Muslims only from a cultural perspective. One has to understand them in terms of the contextual location. So when you look at Muslims in America, or when you look at them in North Africa or South Africa, it's very difficult to begin to think of them as speaking one language as such. So therefore they obviously don't speak the language of the past, but nowadays they are much more influenced by contextual developments of modern societies. I mean, globalization, they are affected by modern state formations. And so therefore, they basically, usually I think they play a role in deconstructing the kind of universalist claim, the kind of claims that are made by people like Bernard Lewis. So if you say, for example, that modern Muslims don't really accept the idea of a nation state. I mean, this is a very popular statement that at the end of the day, the Ummah, the global Muslim community, really represents also the political community for Muslims. Then I think contextualists will actually show you that, you know, nationalism has actually played a very big role in the history of modern Islam. And Muslims have actually contributed to the formation of Turkish nationalism or Arab nationalism or even South Asian or Pakistani nationalism as such. So I'm coming in somehow in between this, and I'm actually saying that I think contextualism is an important response to those who claim that there is no such thing as a modern Muslim nationalism, but I think that they're not going far enough to say that there is something that modern Muslims are actually sharing across the boundaries. The encounter with modernity is helping them to share a discourse, which I call a discourse, a kind of a language that they easily understand with each other. This language is not a coherent theology, but it is a set of patterns of thinking about the state, thinking about gender, thinking about identity that I think is shared across the boundaries. So I think that looking at intellectual history I still think it's fairly underdeveloped. I mean, there have been a number of things, but the more I look at it, I'm still dissatisfied with on the one hand, people saying that, you know, if you study an alim or if you study a religious scholar today, you have to link him whether he's a Sunni or a Shia or he's a Hanafi or a Shafi. I think that those things, you know, may make somewhat important. But I think in addition to the fact that the person is a Sunni or a Shafi or a Salafi, there's some new element in the modern understanding of that term that has crept into it or that has been cultivated. I'm mentioning two. One of them, I said it has been actively cultivated, that's started to say in the book. But I think that one can also speak about how modernity or modernism has somehow affected the discourse, which is actually changed significantly. So I'm sort of talking to the contextualists and actually saying that you're missing a kind of a language that Muslims are sharing. I don't deny that Muslims in Pakistan or India or South Africa are very different. There are lots of different important variations. But I'm also addressing the people who speak about the universal Ummah only and speak about the continuity and actually challenging them that there is something that is new within modern Islam. And it is, I think, an intellectual history which has a lot more to do in order to uncover that difference as such.
Yeah, and this relates to another thing you introduce us to is this relationship between when you're defining religion, you're also defining secularism, and you kind of situate your discussion within this discourse too. Can you explain that?
Yes, I think so. I think it's a good question. Certainly, I mean, we know, as I said with Al-Asad, that the dominant discourse is we no longer think about religion and secular as stable categories. We no longer think of them as, well, that's secular, that's religion, but they are. These terms are, and these discourses are of the secular. How secular is constructed in political or in social life, just as much as a religion is constructed. So, in a way, the history of the emergence of religion, of the idea of religion, the idea of the secular as distinct spheres, is a product of history. It's not something that is, one would expect to see everywhere in the same way. Now, I'm taking that insight, and that comes from Talal Asad and people like Tim Fitzgerald and also David Chittister, and I'm applying it to Islam. Now, I'm aware of the fact that, the tradition is to say, well, actually, there isn't something called secular in Muslim discourse. There isn't something called religion, because if one looks at the history of the term in the emergence of Christianity or the emergence of the medieval church, you don't get something comparable like that in Islam. Well, I'm saying, well, that is well and good, but I think that when one looks at modernity, that there is a secular sphere that begins to impose itself, or, I mean, if one takes it as an imposition on the one hand, or that affects Muslims in a very direct way. And that kind of impact of the secular sphere, if one doesn't want to accept the idea of the secular cultural sphere or the secular artistic sphere, at least I will say that the secular as represented by science, scientific disciplines, or the secular as represented by the state, is something that Muslims have to somehow grapple with, or they actually do grapple with. And my argument is that when they start relating to these spheres as such, then they are implicitly and sometimes explicitly producing the secular. The secular is not something emerges in Muslim discourse as a separate sphere, but it does appear together with religion. So if I should want to take an example of that, I think, which is in my book, that I develop much more clearer in that sense, because I don't see it as a sort of, I don't see secular as pervasive within Muslim societies. But nevertheless, I see that when Muslims speak about the state, there is an awareness that the state functions, for example, have to be somehow given an Islamic background. So the assumption and the recognition is that there is a state which actually operates as a very secular institution. But then Muslim from the 1920s onwards wanted to insert and to say, well, we need to find a sort of a religious justification for that state. And I'm asking, perhaps sometimes I'm told I'm asking too subtly, but I hope that it is clear to the readers and then to the listeners to this program, that at the end of the day, they want to insert kind of a religious element to that which is secular. And I think one can see that throughout. They accept the idea, or they work with modern sciences, for example, and then they ask, you know, can we now Islamize it in some way? And I think that kind of Islamization tells me that there is a secular operating within Muslims. Maybe it's a bit deeply embedded, but I'm using the opportunity to throw it out as such, or to bring it out, to say there is the secular that is operating within Muslim societies, that there is only an ideological resistance against it for various reasons, but there is, at the same time, the way the religion is constructed in modern Islam sort of assumes that there are these different ways of there are these different spheres of these spheres of activity that particularly some Muslims, many Muslims, feel that they should Islamize, that they should invest with the religion. But the fact is that they are dealing with things that are quite secular in that way. I don't know if that is clear, but perhaps you can ask me a question on top of that, then I could maybe elaborate further.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And in relation to that, so required by your title and the nature of your work, you do have to tackle this idea of religion. And in the book, you do this by talking about the term deen and the relationship between Islam, deen, and religion. And there's two people that seem to be influential in your understanding of this, Wilfred Cantwell Smith and Armando Salvatore. I'm wondering if you could discuss this term deen and then how these two authors influenced your understanding of that.
Okay, that's also a good question. It sort of leads me onto what I said earlier. The broader framework of my book is informed by Dalal Asad and by Jayva Chittister. But obviously, when one looks at the history, or at least the scholarship in Islam, then I think that people like Wilfred Cantwell Smith and Salvatore have, I think, made a significant contribution to identifying the uniqueness of modern Islam. But I sort of take from them, but I also then depart from them in a substantial way. I think it's important to recognize what Wilfred Cantwell Smith, you know, already in the early 1960s in his book, The Meaning and End of Religion, I think it was first published in 1962, made a distinction between religion and the religious as such. And I think that analysis is what I take up in my book. But in relation to Islam, his identification that from the 19th century onwards, that Muslims think of Islam as something set apart, something that one can attribute values to. For example, one can speak about what is the value, or what does Islam say on women? What does Islam say on the state? This is his insight into recognizing that is something very important for me as such. And I see that as the beginning of the production of a modern Islamic discourse as such. But where my departure from Wilfred Cantwell Smith is because he actually says, well, let us move away from that, because it's not really very beneficial for, deep reflective thinking. It's not very beneficial for thinking about what he considers to be the object of the reflections on religious studies. And I identify it as a sort of a deeply theological reflection, that rather what we should be paying attention to is you know, what is the religiosity? What is the religious behavior of Muslims? What is the what is religiosity rather than what is religion? So what I take from Wilfred Cantwell Smith is this insight that that the discourse in the 19th century changes, you know, with a focus on Islam. And Muslims no longer say, for example, what does God say or what does the prophet say? I mean, they continue to do that, but they no longer say, for example, when it comes to this is my particular legal school or my particular theological school, they all collapse it under Islam says this. And I think that's a major transition, or at least transformation. I'm saying that actually, well, I mean, I would maybe agree with Wilfred Cantwell Smith that perhaps, you know, reification is not a good place to begin to think about religion. If I think about it, you know, I said in my book that, you know, I did think that that might have been a good idea, but one cannot deny that for the last 120 years or 130 years, Muslims have been doing this and they have invested a certain history on this reification. So my argument is saying, you know, reification might be, you know, too secular. That perhaps for the position of Wilfred Cantwell Smith, it is not really religious because it is a way of apologetics. It is a way of defending Islam. It's not really deep dealing with individual beliefs and individual feelings and experiences, but it is a way of thinking about Islam as something completely separate. And therefore, and matching Islam against everything else as such, and so I do think maybe from a theological point of view that might be problematic, but from a historical point of view, this is what Muslims have been doing, and so there is a history of reification that we should look at. Salvatore adds to this; he comes in much later, but he also picks up on Wilfred Cantwell Smith's argument, and interestingly, he argues that there's a distinction. He also accepts the idea of Islam, but he points out that pre-modern times, Muslim discourse revolved around the idea of deen. That the word deen as such, I mean, I don't think he does a very extensive analysis, but certainly in the earlier experience of the history of Islam, he focuses on the idea that deen was a basis around which a new civilization, a new culture is formed as such. So deen, interestingly, is the framework around which the discussion of Muslims takes place as such. And in the modern period, Islam takes the place of deen. And so the two of them agree with that idea. But for Salvatore, sort of basically suggests to us the kind of difference as such. Now, I don't want to go into the merits of deen as such, but because that might take us about thinking about how we can speak about a discourse in pre-modern Islam. Maybe that's a subject for another book. But let me say what Salvatore says about what happens to Islam in the modern world. So he sort of develops Wilfred Cantwell Smith's argument and suggests that that Islam as a term in this discourse becomes part of a global hermeneutical exercise, hermeneutical circles he calls them, that over a period of 100 years, you know, Europeans are beginning to identify what Islam is. Muslims themselves are responding to this, this identification, and there is a convergence and a divergence among different groups, Muslims as well as Europeans or Western people as such, to think about what Islam is and what is the meaning of Islam. So he's in a sense giving content to the meaning of Salvatore. Now I pick that up as such. I think it's significant. Where I depart from Salvatore is that I think he is quite happy to see that that Islamic modernism around this term Islam, or let's call it modernism of North Africa or the Middle East, because that is his focus, is a modernism of Islam, modernism of Muslims or Arabs around the term of Islam. Islam becomes a basis for talking about liberalism, or about authenticity and about identity. So there's a kind of a mirror image between what happens in Europe and what happens on the other side of the Mediterranean. Sometimes it's completely as reflective of these. You can immediately identify discourses about identity, nationalism, authenticity, and sometimes you can see some divergences as well. Now, I think that I don't disagree with him fundamentally on that, But I when I started looking at the literature that that I've presented in my book, on from Syed Ahmed Khan all the way up to people like Abdullah Naim, I think that there is not only a mirror image, but there is a kind of a divergence in the meaning of modernity among Muslims. That Islamic modernity as such is very, very is not only a mirror image of liberalism and secularism or liberalism and identity, but there are very distinctive patterns that are being developed by Muslims from the 19th century onwards, and that are then being shared across. So I think that, you know, I don't want to deny that there is this kind of an exchange taking place, but I think there is also a Muslim discourse that is quite distinctive from the dominant themes that you are getting from Europe as such. And this is how I sort of, both Wilfred Cantwell Smith and Salvatore, I depend on them. I depend on them to have identified these elements. But I then depart from them by saying, well, let's look at, you know, on what basis is this discourse now developed? And when I bring in the notion of religion, then I begin to see that there are fundamental some uniqueness in the modern construction of Islam, in the modern construction around Islam, in those themes as such, which I think are worthy of putting up, and that's what I've done in my book.
Yeah, definitely, it's a great contribution you've made. Let's move into some of these debates that you discuss. You begin geographically with South Asian intellectuals. You introduce us to Syed Ahmed Khan, Muhammad Iqbal, and Fazlur Rahman. Why don't you discuss some of the new challenges that are presented by modernity and how these thinkers discuss religion in relation to those?
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot for that. I started with India. I wasn't planning to do that initially. I thought my expertise is much more in Arabic literature as well as in Islam in Africa. But when I looked at some of the earliest reflections by people like Syed Ahmed Khan, I was actually struck by it, by what he was writing, and by what he was responding to. I mean, one of the things that struck me about Syed Ahmed Khan is he's one of the very first people, and one of the very few people I would rush to add, among particularly intellectuals who are working, I'm not talking about people who are based at universities, but I'm talking about activist intellectuals, if I can call them that, or organic intellectuals, who basically, he's one of those few actually, and at a very early age, identified that that modern scientific modern science as such is very, very different from the scientific enterprise of medieval Islam, because the usual understanding is that actually, you know, Muslims have contributed a lot to modern science, and so therefore there's an assumption that there is a continuity between somebody like Al-Khwarizmi or somebody like Al-Biruni to modern science, Einstein or so. And I think that somebody like Syed Ahmed Khan recognized there is a fundamental break between Aristotelian science and then medieval science and then modern science. And he also recognized the fact that actually if your basic theology is founded upon Aristotelian principles, then you need to find new principles. You need to find new justifications for Islam in the modern world. So that's the kind of things that that alerted my attention to say, well, you know, it's very, very significant. And my argument is that it's the Indian scholars who are consistently finding this. I mean, obviously, at the moment, this idea is much more broadly shared as such, but to get somebody in the 19th century to recognize that was something quite, I think, intriguing to me, and I haven't seen that pointed to by any other scholar as such. If one continues with that, then somebody like Muhammad Iqbal as well, somebody who comes from, obviously, much more exposed to European philosophy by Nietzsche and opposed to what one might call the sort of the anti the Romantic philosophers, or I was going to say anti-modernist ones, but certainly the 19th century Romantic tradition that Iqbal sort of inserts into his understanding as well. When you look at his reconstruction of religious thought, he's very much aware that you cannot, you can go back to Rumi. I mean, he's fascinated by Rumi. You can go back to some of the earlier philosophers, but he's also aware of the fact that there is a major change and you have to fundamentally reconstruct religious thought. And Fazlur Rahman is equally, I think, aware of this change as such. So it's a kind of an intellectual change that I've identified in this first. It's intellectual change coming from particularly from science and the meaning of science that actually moves people, these three individuals, to offer a different interpretation of Islam.
Another one of the challenges discussed that modernity brings is colonialism, and there's really no way for Muslims in the modern period to not deal with colonialism. So, what role did religion play in formulation the political impact of colonialism?
Well, to be honest with you, I think this particular aspect of colonialism I see throughout in many different aspects. I mean, it's still a very dominant trope in Muslim understanding as such, the meaning of colonialism. But I don't necessarily. Well, I could identify it. I mean, maybe, you know, I've written the book about the book has been published about 18 months, so sometimes I can forget elements of it. But thanks a lot for asking.
Sure.
Just thinking about. Now, where did I refer that to? Okay.
Sure. Well, so you introduce us to Jamal ad-Din Afghani and Muhammad Abduh,
yes.
And how they
okay.
how they discuss religion in,
yeah.
in this as,
yeah,
framework.
Thank you very much. As I was thinking, I was thinking, now where did I come across this? And by the time I came to the end of my words, I said, oh, yes, okay, that's my second chapter. That's right. Because I also dealt with the notion of politics as such, of the Islamic State, but that's a different chapter.
Sure.
Well, I think that the aspect, the reality of colonialism and the impact of colonialism comes up very differently in the Indian scholars compared to what I would call home, let's say the Middle Eastern, Iran, and if one thinks about Jamaluddin Afghani, Iran, and Egypt as such. And I home in on Jamaluddin Afghani and Abduh in my second chapter, and there I'm talking about a different approach to Islam. And that approach is actually very much driven by a particular understanding of politics, particularly colonial politics as such. Whereas Sayyid Ahmad Khan reconciles himself to colonial hegemony or the colonial state in India. And one might add, for example, even though Muhammad Iqbal was much more a strident political activist than Khan was, but he also accepted the British presence in one way or another. On the other hand, somebody like Jamaluddin Afghani and Abduh take a much more oppositional stand as such. I mean, they basically argue that Muslims need to organize themselves, they need to resist colonial authority. And now a number of people did that, but what is distinctive about them, and that's where they end up in my book, is that they also argue that Muslims have to rethink the meaning of Islam in order to mount this resistance against colonial authorities and colonial power. And when I look carefully at Jamaluddin Afghani and the work of Abduh, what I notice is they also engage in a very distinctive and a kind of a re-engagement of the meaning of Islam. They pick up from what has gone in the past, but what they insert in it is a very functionalist understanding of Islam. They basically think about Islam as a political project, essentially a political project, as a way in which Islam provides the basis for changing the society and also changing the social structure of the society as such. So by thinking about Islam as a means of resistance as such, they actually introduce some fundamental changes in the meaning of Islam form Muslim for Muslim societies, to the extent that today it might be impossible for people, somebody to say, I remember a couple of years ago when I had already written this this chapter and I was asked to present some of my findings to a Muslim audience, then I suggested to them that that in the past, for example, you could actually argue God's favor doesn't necessarily equal to political success, because sometimes you can be actually God can actually visit you with political failure in order to bring you back to the right path. As such, one should not necessarily think of development equal Islam. That Islam doesn't necessarily mean that you would have economic or social development. I think what Abdu and Jamaluddin Afghani was doing is that if Muslims go back to Islam, then they would actually find in it social and political success. And they basically made an equation between Islam and political and success as such. And I then went into, in this chapter, I looked very carefully at the definitions of Islam and the way they looked at the foundations of Islam. And I argue within the book that every time when Muslims return to Islam, then they would actually get political success. If Muslims turn away from Islam, they would be actually visited with no political or no social success as such. And I'm taking the cue from religious studies to say that this was a particularly functionalist approach, functionalist definition of Islam. I also picked up on the idea that there were in the 1960s, Ali Kaduri, who has written a book saying that people like Abdu and people like Afghani actually may not have been believers, that they had themselves had doubts about Islam, doubts of Islam as believers. They had probably stopped believing what they were saying. And there was a lot of controversy about them. And there's still occasionally some controversy about what these modernists are. My argument was saying, well, that might or might not be true. Or at least I could understand that. But what I was identifying from this was to say that this definition of Islam, this functionalist definition of Islam, was actually a kind of a secular approach to Islam. So maybe this is also another way where the secular comes in. Mm-hmm. So the meaning of Islam was less connected with an individual's relationship with God, with sacred, with belief as such, but directly connected with political life and political commitment as such. And so therefore there is this, what I was saying, that secular comes together. I gave another example about how the secular emerges to be Islamized, but here you have the secular that is very deeply embedded into an understanding of Islam.
Yeah, and then in the next chapter you move on to discussing the formation of religious identity for these modernists, and then you compare it with some Islamicists, specifically Hassan al-Banna and Maududi. Can you discuss this relationship?
Yes. Yeah, I think that for me, it was also something noticeable. Every time I was looking at these chapters, I was, as I said, attentive to, very explicitly attentive to when people would actually begin to say, "Well, this is what religion. This is the meaning of religion." And I was aware that. While I would find that in most cases, when you turn to Islamists, that you would not automatically find this, because you would immediately find that actually Islam is not a religion. So you'd always have a denial of it. And how do you go about doing that? Well, the first thing that I found is that when I looked at Islamists, is the continuity between Islamism, between modernism and Islamism. And that continuity, which has generally been accepted now, but sometimes, especially in the last 10 years or so, when the difference between Islamists, because of their association with radicalism, and modernists is often overemphasized, at least is not recognized as such. So the first thing I did was to show that when you look at people like Abul Ala Maududi and even Hassan al-Banna, there is a very close relationship between them and their predecessors, the modernists like Sayyid Ahmed Khan or Muhammad Iqbal on the one side and Abdu on the other. So there is, the discourses are very sort of in a way connected as such. But then when I'm more carefully looked at how people like, if I take specific examples, I think it would be better to look at Hassan al-Banna. I focus on Hassan al-Banna, Maududi, and Sayyid Qutb to think about how they spoke about Islam, how they wrote about Islam, and sometimes how they defined it, and also in many cases how they defined Islam. I found that within their discourses, there was a very close connection between how they defined Islam as a discourse of identity. The one example that I can immediately remember that I can think of is somebody like Hassan al-Banna, for example, speaks about in the 1930s, for example, begins to speak about Islam as a cause. And the word that he uses is Islam as a cause like other causes. It's a da'wah. So that would one would think that the word da'wah that he uses is, you know, classical Islam, that it speaks about mission. But he says that it is a cause like others, like da'awat, other causes. And when you follow through what he means by these other causes, he is referring to nationalism, socialism of the 1920s in Egypt at that time. So he's identifying Islam as a political project with a distinctive identity. So this is how I begin to see how the emphasis on identity from the Islamists begins at a very early stage, not only when we begin to see the dominance of Islamists in the 1970s, already from the 1920s and 30s, that sort of comes up very clearly. More importantly, on the second level, with all the Islamists, all the three that I've mentioned, Hassan al-Banna, Maududi, and Qutb, what you also see is the importance of the self. The individual, as such, for al-Banna, for example, he emphasizes quite extensively on the unique character of the Arab Muslims. And I must say that, you know, personally, as somebody from Muslim background myself, I was quite surprised at this, you know, because you always, when one thinks about the normal discourse of saying, you know, in Islam, race is not so important, or it's not so important to be thinking about, you know, Arabs or South Asians, for example. Within al-Banna and the Islamists, the Arab Islamists particularly, Arabness plays a very important role. And the Arab leadership of the Muslims as such is taken for granted. It comes out in some of the earlier discussions, and I think you'll see that through in other Islamists, other Arab Islamists, even including Ismail Faruqi much later in America, taking forward this idea of the leadership of the Arabs. But I see that as a deep issue of identity, of religious kind of religious nationalism, in this case of an Islamic Arab nationalism, if I can call it, being inserted into discourse of Islamists as such. But that is not all that you find with identity. You also look further and you see that, particularly with Qutb and with Maududi, there is the self as such becomes very, very important in this construction of, you know, what is this Islamic cause, this distinctive Islamic cause. At the end of the day, when you look at the discussion, it turns around that the individual self has to have a certain perception of Islam, and that perception has to be deeply ingrained in the self as such. So I try to sort of follow through. It's much more difficult to perhaps put it explicitly without giving long quotations, but I think that for the Islamist identity, what was surprising to me, because initially I mean, one thinks about identity as external. The Islamist identity is external, about putting on certain clothes and certain kind of Islamic formulations of the state has to have certain Islamic trappings as such. I mean, I'm not saying that those are not important for Islamists, but even before you come there, when you home in on when there are difficulties about how to reconcile Islam in the modern world, then they turn and say, well, this is, at the end of the day, you need to have an Islamic self that would actually be the main, the foundations of the modern project. With Hassan al-Banna, it is the self, which is the Arab self. On the other hand, when you sit down to Qutb and to Maududi, and Qutb took it from Maududi, it is a self that is that is somehow in tune with the laws of nature, with the laws of nature, which for them are the laws of God. So human beings are natural, I mean, in the sense that they are part of nature, but they are determined by the laws of nature. The laws of nature are taken from, from 19th century understandings of physical science. But then those laws of nature are then said to be exactly the same as scientific laws of nature. And therefore, at the end of the day, the human self is really an Islamic in a very deeper sense. It doesn't, what I'm trying to say is that it doesn't leave, it leaves very little space, I think. On the one hand, it sort of shows you how deeply embedded is Islam in the self. It obviously, in comparison with maybe perhaps classical understandings of Islam, it leaves very little space for when is a person entitled to say you don't believe or you believe in something else. And I think the classical Islamic tradition, you know, while they might actually say that disbelievers are going to hell, but they actually also recognize that maybe God has a role in that place as well. Whereas the Islamists, in terms of this thinking of this identity, which is so deeply rooted in the self and which is Islamic, actually leaves very little space but for Islam, and very little space for this for self in any other way.
And then moving from the self, you actually go towards the state, and you discuss the meaning and symbolism of the Islamic state. Here you introduce us to Ali Abdul Razak. Can you discuss how he talks about the idea of a caliphate?
Yes, thank you very much for that. Yeah, I think that for me, Ali Abdul Razak is quite crucial, not because he has been followed, but I think he sets up the kind of problematic. He writes his book just soon at the end of after the First World War, and it is a year or two before the abolishment of the caliphate in 1924 by the Turkish Parliament. And he puts up a thesis which has been criticized and which continues to be criticized. I think that, and let me say what it is briefly. Basically, he argues that that one should distinguish between the religious role of the Prophet and the political and his political role. And for him to make the distinction, I think is something that. I mean, I literally became alert whenever some Muslim intellectual makes it. As you might imagine, right now I'm sort of looking through and see what does it actually mean and what are the implications of that. So he makes the distinctions of what the Prophet was. He tries to show where was the Prophet. He tries to show from the Quran, particularly to say what was the Prophet as a religious leader and what was he as a political leader. And he sort of makes that distinction. And then he also says that post-prophetic political history has always been political, and he does just use religion as such. So his thesis is that, you know, Muslims have, as people who follow the Prophet, they should not actually be following him as a political leader. They should be following him in his religious capacity. And so therefore, he set up this practice that if in the modern world we can have a secular state, but we still preserve religion, and religion and state should actually be completely separated as such. Now, this thesis of his was entirely argued from the Quran, from religious discussions. I mean, he has been criticized, as I said, he has been extensively criticized because he dared to say that, you know, there was no such a thing as a religious state in Islam, and religion and state are not completely combined with each other. I took that argument of his and actually tried to follow how a number of people responded to him immediately. Like Rashid Rida. Was also a famous Egyptian scholar, I just forget his name right now, who also responded, and he wrote his PhD thesis on that. So he's one of the modernist thinkers as well of Egypt. And then I also followed up somebody like Khalid Muhammad Khalid, who wrote about that in the early 1930s, and then later what I thought culminating in Maududi's work on the Islamic State, written in 1939. So I take a number of these writings in Arabic, in Arab world, as well as in the Indo-Pakistan world. Those are the two worlds that I'm working with, and I'm looking at how they are responding to what I think is a thesis presented by Ali Abdul Razak. I mean, they they don't all respond directly to Ali Abdul Razi, but I think that they are responding to the problematic that he has presented. The problematic is, you know, you have the religious function in what he says, the religious function of the Prophet, the political function. But I think the problematic is that in a modern society, I think the problematic that he raised is that you have a political state. You have a political state which is secular. And his argument is you don't need to give it any kind of religious significance. You don't need to add anything religion to it because it wasn't supposed to be like that in the first place. Now, the others who follow him, who responded to him, in my view, who respond to him, are interestingly because they reject his main thesis that you should combine religion and politics. I mean, they argue that it should be combined, but they try to find where religion should be. What is the location of religion in all of this in a modern state? And that I find is quite fascinating because I think that sort of shows me, and I'm showing to the reader, that the state is actually has actually functioned in a very as functions and its characteristics, which one may say as are very secular. I mean, it exercises a certain amount of power, exercises legislation. Excuse me, but and the concern among Muslim intellectuals, modern Muslim intellectuals, is saying, well, where do we put it there? And if I could just take the example of Rashid Rida, for example, and maybe take the example of Maududi, just at the two pole ends, just to illustrate this. Somebody like Rashid Rida basically says, well, we shouldn't have it. We should combine these things. We need a good religious state. We need a moral state. I mean, he makes those claims as such. But then when he speaks about the actual working of the state in relation to religion, he actually presents a very, very liberal state. He basically, in the state, is actually, what I think he does is that there is nothing that actually stays, that really remains from religion within the state. Because he says legislation has to be, it's important that we need to have a kind of a legislative body. And the legislative body has to be dependent on the Sharia. But then when he says, what is the Sharia? The Sharia is something that can actually be changed depending on the circumstances. That is his main argument in his book. So on the one hand, he wants to have a religious state. But when it comes to what is the nature of the religious law in the state, it's a very liberal, it's a very open, open to change, according to the circumstances as such. So I wonder, where is this religion going to be now? You know, where does this, according to Rashid Rida, I'm asking him, you know, where does it actually stay? Is it only in the title of the state that it must be an Islamic state, or is it in something else? Because it doesn't seem to be in the legislation. And so that's why I'm trying to follow through. I'm looking at Muslim intellectuals, and I think that I would even argue that this is a continuing preoccupation of Muslims thinking about the modern state, is where do you actually put religion in? Until we come to somebody like Maududi, who writes this very small tract, but a very influential tract in the political theory of the Islamic State. And in this small booklet of his, he actually equates God with the state, where the state apparatus becomes Islam itself, or becomes God. It is a, you know, there's a place for people to vote, there's a place for a democracy, but at the end of the day, the state actually takes the place of God. I think one can actually say, I'm not in the business of theology, but I mean, that's quite almost like you can see where we start off from to say, well, we need a role for the state, but then you say, well, the state actually represents religion, represents the theos, represents the force of God as such. And I think I think that many people will reject that association, that kind of distinction. But I think that it also opens the case for first of all, I'm telling the reader that there are these variations, there's this kind of problematic that has to be addressed, but I'm also showing how the kind of totalitarian elements of the modern Islamic state are being introduced by people like Maududi, who don't want to accept the idea that, you know, maybe we should actually create some kind of separation. So in refusing to allow for a separation, he's actually going all the way to say, well, the state has to make a decision. The state makes a decision, the legislation or the head of state then makes a decision, what is right, what is wrong. We're actually going back, you know, perhaps to the Umayyad Khalifs who were authoritarian. I mean, we're going back to pre-Ma'mun, if I could bring in a sort of a medieval Abbasid politics. You know, since the time of Ma'mun, it was very clear in Muslim society that there is political authority and religious authority are going will be clearly be separated. And I see Mawdudi basically trying to breach that, or at least trying to destroy that kind of distinction. But where does he actually go to with that? Does he go to the caliphs of the Umayyads, which he rejects? Does he go back to the Prophet? And can you have a state leader today taking on the role of the Prophet? And that is highly problematic from a theological point of view. But I think that is the kind of suggestions that are made by certainly Islamists like Mawdudi when they're trying to answer the question that was posed by Ali Abdul Razik.
Then moving from the state, you discuss how religion can be implemented through a legal code. Could you briefly discuss kind of the positions of Asif Faizi and Abdullahi Anayim?
Yeah. Yes, that's it's almost impossible to think about Islam without thinking about the Sharia, without thinking about the law. So I'm, again, as in the other chapters, I'm start with the idea that there is a transformation of the Sharia in modernity, beginning with again colonial construction of the Sharia, particularly in India. But the Sharia begins is one of before I speak about these individuals, let me just say what I wanted to say was that the Sharia is seen as law, as a law of the state, as such, as a law of the state that has to be, that is equivalent to the legislation that comes from a parliament. And I think that is a association that was made initially in India already in the 17th and 18th century with the British, and then it has been adopted by the Muslims from in the 19th and 20th century. So having looked at that, I thought let me look at at least two or three intellectuals to see what is their understanding of the Sharia and what is their understanding of law as such, to see how do they try to deal with this notion of Sharia and the law as such. I didn't look at Sanhuri. I mean, that's the person that I wanted to say earlier. Sanhuri also responded to Ali Abdul Razik with his doctoral dissertation on the Islamic State. He was very similar to his position. He's very very self consciously modernist, but anyway, his position was very similar to Ali Abdul Razik. But sorry for the diversion. Let me come back to Faizi and Naim. Faizi and Naim are quite interesting, I think, because in a way they are trying to resist this idea of Islamic law as legislation. I mean, very similar to what I said earlier about Sayyid Ahmad Khan, who recognizes the impact of modern science. What we see with Faizi and Naim, they see the distinction between Sharia and law, and they want to keep that distinction. And so both of them, in different ways, coming from at different periods of time. Faizi basically is a product of the British colonial colonial history, is a product of India. And so he sees, in a sense, he actually argues, he sees the place of Sharia in the legislature of a state. So as far as Faizi is concerned, the Sharia can be continued to develop. It is part of the state. It can be developed within the state. But then it should continuously be developed as it was in the past before. So he's sort of accepting the kind of modern development of the Sharia, like like most other Muslims. But he is open to saying that it doesn't have to be fixed in a particular time. As a good modernist, he is actually thinking, no, the Sharia has always changed in the past. Therefore, in modern legislatures, one should, the change should continue. More importantly, one can bring in new ideas from human rights. One can bring new elements from new principles of value as such, just like earlier Muslim scholars had done in the past. For example, if one thinks about the maqasid of the Sharia, the goals of the Sharia were introduced, you know, earlier by Ghazali and then developed by the Maliki schools in Spain, for example. Much has been written about that as well. Now, I think I'm using it as an example for Fayzi to think that, well, now if one thinks about, you know, the British law of what they considered repugnance as such, Fayzi was not really, you know, was fazed by that. He said, well, you know, sometimes laws that are coming from the past are repugnant to our modern sensibilities, and we should not feel afraid of changing them in terms of what we think, what is the common good today. But what is interesting about Fayzi is that because while he accepted this, you know, Sharia as legislature, he also then wrote quite a number of essays to speak about how, you know, that is no longer religion, that Sharia is legislature, and so therefore he fully accepted the idea that this then becomes a very secular practice. But on the other hand, he wrote a number of interesting essays which were compiled in a collected book over a number of years, articles that he had written over a number of years. And within that, he basically espoused an understanding of religion that and his understanding of religion is much more mystical, it is much more universal. But what I found interesting is that that is to do with the self. So religion, the Sharia, in a sense, becomes legislative, becomes secular, whereas religion needs to be cultivated around the self, and it has to be, in his view, certainly much more, going much more in the direction of this philosophical or more importantly, the Sufi understanding of the universal religion as such. For me, that was just quite an illustration about how modern Muslim intellectuals grappling with, you know, what the conditions of the time are, then wanting to, on the one hand, separating, okay, that's secular, and this is somewhat in the important part of religion as such. On the other hand, when one looks at a Na'im coming a bit later, he faces a bit more difficult task because he comes in at a time, he becomes active in the 1970s, and he starts writing also in the context of an ascendant Islamist campaigns from the 1970s onwards, which are demanding that the Sharia has to be part of the state as such. And he challenges that approach. He doesn't accept the idea of an Islamic state. He doesn't, unlike Fayzi, he doesn't also accept the idea of the Sharia as legislature, but he puts the Sharia particularly within the context of the public sphere. And he says the Sharia should be the values that Muslims must debate, you know, extensively within the public sphere. So in his case, for example, he's also accepting this, at least this kind of distinction between, you know, between a sort of a secular state, and he has since written a book which actually espouses this in a very significant way, to say that Muslims must accept an Islamic state, but the Islamic debate in the public sphere is a kind of a Habermasian model of the public sphere. But the only distinction is that he thinks that in Muslim societies, Muslims would actually be contributing to the debate from religious values as such. But when I look more closely at Na'im, he also seems to be saying, while he seems to be conceding, well, in the public sphere, you have a debate on Islam, or you have a debate on all kinds of values. But when a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew enters the public sphere, he says that you need to argue on the basis of universal values as to what you want for the state as such. The state itself should never accept any particular religious argumentation. So he also tends to, I think in his argumentation, tends to promote religion at a highly individualistic, the religion is something that motivates you at a very personal level, at a highly individualistic, at an interior level. In the public sphere, though, you have to engage with universal rules, universal values, in order to compete or in order to share a discourse with others or with either secularists or atheists or other religious groupings and such. In terms of my broader analysis of this, is that I'm showing a Na'im, and as well as Fayzi, to be actually turning towards the individual sense in which to promote a particular interior sense of where the cultivation of religion should be. One of them accepting the Sharia as legislator, the other not accepting as Sharia legislator. But I think this particular chapter, if you permit me a few more minutes on this, the particular chapter will not be complete if I point out to a completely different example of Taqi Usmani, who is a Diobandi scholar, traditionalist scholar, one of the few traditionalist scholars that I've actually looked at more carefully, and I feel that I should look at them a bit more carefully in future. But when I looked at Taqi Usmani's understanding of Sharia as well, I also turn around and say, well, at the end of the day, he is espousing a very explicit religious identity in the Sharia. He doesn't take the views of Faizi or of Naim, but at the end of the day, he also espouses a very interiorized understanding of Sharia for the individual Muslim who is engaging in Islamic economic activity. So all in all, I'm arguing that when the Sharia becomes directly or indirectly part of the legislature, directly as in Faizi, through the public sphere, but not directly as in Naim, and very explicitly as part of a Muslim community identity in the case of Taqi Usmani, at the end of the day, the essence of the Sharia has become interiorized in the modern world. And I think this kind of interiorization of the Sharia is something that one needs to look at a bit more carefully. I hope that I have made a case for that in this particular chapter.
Yeah, no, I think it comes across very clear. You wrap the book up discussing the role of Islamic feminism in the modern Islamic discourse. Could you discuss that briefly?
Yes, I think, thank you very much. For me, Islamic feminists, particularly the two that I've chosen, but also others as well, I've been reading about them, some of my colleagues and some of people that I have read, mainly at people who have been at universities in a number of places in the world. I've looking very carefully at them, and I'm in this particular chapter. I think it comes together because for several reasons. The one is, I show that, again, like I've shown for the others, I show the indebtedness to other Muslims. I take the example of Zinuddin. Nazira Zinuddin from what's his place name? Okay, sorry about that. I was taking the example of this. You have to help me, Kristen. What is the one is I'm taking Amina Wadud from America, and she's very. I think her ideas are very closely connected to Fazlur Rahman. Nazira Zinuddin, on the other hand, in the Levant, is closely connected with Abdu. So the two of them, you know, in both cases, they are, in the one case, for example, Zira Zinuddin is very much influenced, or she takes Abdu as opening up a new chapter for Islam in the modern world, for Arab societies, and she takes it forward. Amina Wadud also picks up the ideas from Fazlur Rahman, his ideas about contextualism, his ideas that the new context of modernity should call upon us to rethink some values that we have, some of the explicit values in relation to women, in relation to non-Muslims as such, and minorities in Muslim societies or Muslim states as such. So I follow up both of them in their close relationship with these modernists, or these, let me call them modernists for the moment, but I also show where they, in both cases, they show how they significantly depart from them. In the case of Nazira Zinuddin, for example, I think she places a much more emphasis on individual conscience and religion than what I have seen with Abdu as such. I'm not saying Abdu did not worry about the conscience at all or did not say that, but in his formulation of Islam, I see a much more functionalist approach to Islam. Islam is going to be good for the development of political society, whereas Nazira Zinuddin is very clear in Lebanon, for example, that the particular Islam for her, for example, at the end of the day, it's a conscience, it's her own conscience, as her conscience. And she draws from extensively from early Islamic literature in order to support her argument that it's a conscience that will actually make a decision, make the difference as to what she does in a particular time. She was, in her book, she was arguing against the idea that Muslim women should actually cover their faces in 1929. That was the thrust of a book. But I was not so much interested in that debate as such about veiling, but I was more interested in seeing how does she actually how does she actually situate her argument. And her, while she actually goes to all the Quranic verses in order to show that women do not need to be have their face veiled as such according to the traditions, she also, at the end of the day, takes much more, places much more emphasis on her as an individual believer. Well, Duhut comes in much later, and she's still writing about it, but I think that looking at her two or three books that she's written from 1990s, I see her indebtedness to Fazlur Rahman that she claims, but I also see the shift in Duhut from being engaged in reading the Quran, deriving something from the Quran, reading the Quran in context, as Fazlur Rahman had said, to a position where she is a reader, where the reader takes takes a much more dominant role than the particular the text itself. I was once asked about what is the difference between aren't you reading all the time? So I think that those who are familiar with this is a kind of a postmodernist turn, I think, that Wadud brings to the study of Islam. A postmodernist turn which emphasizes the fact that, you know, it's the reader that makes the meaning rather than the text that actually gives something or the other. And Fazlur Rahman was very, very insistent on the fact that the text actually can produce meanings. Wadud, on the other hand, is in many cases actually going on the other side, is saying that I am giving meaning to the text as such. Now, for me, this chapter sort of wraps it all together. It wraps it all, the chapter wraps it together, because I think in a way it shows that in all of the chapters of the book, there is a very clear separation, there's a clear gap between Islam, Islamic discourse, or maybe Islamic teachings that are inherited from the past, and modern societies and modernity, if I can call it in this kind of a comprehensive term. That modernity, meaning the modern state, modern science, developments of technology, the development, new globalization, coming together of different people from different values together. All of these pose challenges to received understandings of Islam. And until I came to the feminists, I think that most Muslim intellectuals that I've read seem to think that Islam, has the answer. But I'm also shown that in order for Islam to have the answer, they've had to make some significant changes and significant fundamental changes about how to think Islam. That's why they've reconstructed Islam, reconstructed the meaning of Islam in the light of all these challenges coming at them from all sides. They've thought that basically if you can read the text differently, if you can take different elements from the text, maybe you can have a modern Islamic discourse. What I think the feminists do is actually say that there's a limit to how you can read the text. There's a limit to how you can adjust the text for the modern world. And so for me, the feminists, Nazira Zuddin and Amina Wadud, in very different ways, one of them emphasizing a deep sense of, a sense of individual conscience, the other basically saying that, the agency is mine. I can decide what Islam is for me today. And that poses brings about a very different dimension. It's still part of the modern Islamic discourse, but it actually poses a very important challenge to what has gone for the rest of the book, and also brings out the kind of, unspoken problems that Muslims have actually been confronting. But particularly because of the issues of gender, those cannot be unspoken because the texts are so clear and so problematic for at least for some Islamic feminists as such.
Yeah, I think you do a great job covering this, and I'm glad you did include this at the end of the book. Now, we really have taken a lot of your time, but before you go, could you just tell us what new projects you're working on now?
Well, you know, the one is that I'm continuing to work on modern Muslim intellectuals. So that is, I think, after this book, I'm going to continue with that. And I've been writing a number of articles that are looking at this. For example, I have written an article on Ismail Faruqi that's going to come out in Newman sometime this year. But I'm thinking that's something that I will keep in mind. I'm also working on what might develop into a sequel, but at the moment I'm writing this as an individual article, which I will present at a conference later this year. It's to think about the history of modern Islamic thought and theology. One of the things that I've noticed in my book is that I haven't looked specifically at whether this, what I've written about in this book, can actually be seen as a new theology. So I want to pose slightly different questions to this, to these discourses, to these discussions, but probably look at some other people. But I'm fascinated by thinking about this. If one thinks about this as theology, then I think one can ask maybe medieval questions to these questions. What is a Muslim? What is a community? What is a society? And actually come up with a slightly different, at least maybe a sequel to this book. So that's the one thing I'm working on. The other that I'm working on at the moment is a study of Islamism, with which I actually started of the Muslim Youth Movement book in 1995. I'm extending that to other parts of Africa. It's a collaborative work, but I'm taking the leadership in that to look at Islamism from a psychology of religion's perspective. I want to look more clearly at the meaning of religion for Islamists, so you can see the link between again. But now I want to look at it from their biographical backgrounds. And in some cases, particularly, there's two projects. One of them is on Islam only, but the other is on a project that I'm working on East Africa, particularly in Zanzibar, in Tanzania, in Kenya, where I want to bring together both Christian and Muslim materials, look at evangelical Christianity and reformist Islam or revivalist Islam or Islamic resurgence, and actually look at biographical, collect biographies of these particular leaders and then compare them with each other. So the one is I'm interested in continuing this direction that I've taken in this book, and the other is to look at Islamism religious revival in individual biographical perspective.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again for joining us. We look forward to seeing those new projects as they come out. And I think your book is really wonderful, and I think it's going to become essential reading both for people who want to know more about modern Islam, but also religion in modern society. So thank you for your contribution.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And that was my interview with Abdulkader Tayyub, professor of religion at the University of Cape Town, South Africa, about his new book, Religion in Modern Islamic Discourse.